So I, for my birthday, and I've been holding on to this. I haven't told you about it yet because I've been saving it for a cold open.
Live reveal for the listeners.
And this is going to be...
Listen, listeners, you keep Jamie keeping secrets. Okay.
So I got my first ever cameo. Have you ever gotten a cameo?
I've never received one. Wow. I'm like very anxious to know who this possibly could have come from.
I guess like before I reveal, like I didn't even think I would tease it like this, but do you have any guesses? Just quickly take one guess.
Oh, somebody, a housewife?
No, but very good guess. I'll just tell you that it is my most favorite sister wife, third wife, Christine Brown.
Oh my God, you got from the sister... Oh, my God.
It was,
oh,
she did such a good job. She really spent the time on it.
I'm sorry, but I just real quick, and I want to hear about it, but I just want to express, like, how happy I am.
I know. It's one of the truly the best gifts I've ever received.
Did Maddie get this for you?
She did.
Oh, Maddie. I mean, I was like, no one else could be this much of an angel, but, like, or just understand you on such a deep, visceral level, but just... Wow. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to get a cameo from a sister wife? And did you feel crazy when she like said your name?
Yes. And to hear the Brown family accent tickle across my name because they say things like big dill, like they and like mills instead of meals. Like,
how did they pronounce your name?
Well, Maddie said that it was too jam. And she, Christine said, "Hi, Jum."
Oh man!
Yeah, and so she wished me a happy birthday, and then she was that like it's like I don't know the timestamps. I want to say this video is like almost 5 minutes long though. Like she really
wow.
It was worth every penny, however much it was, because this woman
you're
put
like,
in
it was
the
worth
time.
Every penny that I didn't spend. Keep going, okay.
Mm-hmm. And. So I've never like sent a cameo to anyone, but Maddie said when you like request one, you only have like a certain amount of characters that you can type for a message, like Twitter, like you can only like put so many things in your request. And so she was typing to Christine to tell her that it was going to be for my birthday and that we had binged all of Sister Wives recently and that she was our favorite. And that she said, mentioned that my favorite moment was in an earlier season, maybe season 4, when the family is talking about my sister wife's closet, which is the...
Is this their business?
Terrible business that favorite wife Robin has, but like isn't lucrative in any way and is really stupid. They're all sitting at the table having a business meeting, and Robin is like crying
about a non-lucrative business.
Totally,
you know?
She's just draining the family's money, and she's
draining
Robin,
it away.
Robin is complaining about how, like, the other wives aren't like pitching in as much as she thought because, like, Robin needs everyone to do everything for her. And
I mean, listen, they're out here.
At this point, Christine, who is like the true like mom of the family, like she watches like almost all the kids while other people go to work or like do things outside the house. Like she's had a hand in raising all the kids. Anyway, Christine looks straight ahead and says, "I was never planning to do more than this." And it's one of my most favorite moments. It's one of a handful of very chaotic Christine moments that are my absolute favorite because I don't like Robin. But Maddie must have mentioned something really briefly about that moment in the message because in the video, like at the beginning, she's like, happy birthday. And I did need to tell you that I was never planning to do more than this. And so that bitch remembered years ago, 10 years ago, this moment where she was being catty to her sister wife and I loved it. And it was just like the camaraderie that I could see in her eyes.
Like she was also like, yeah, you fucking get me, bitch.
Totally.
Like
she knew that I was Team Christine all the way. And I don't usually like to pick sides, but in this case, it's 100% Christine. She's the one that's currently left the family. I don't know where she was in this cameo because she was appeared to be on like a white vinyl couch and behind her was like a mushroom tapestry. It was not what I expected.
I mean, I'm open to it.
But she did leave the family, and she's decided to divorce Cody. And TBD on that, the show isn't caught up to that, but that's what is happening in real life. So I love Christine, and I had to tell you about that cameo. Yeah, that's the whole thing.
I mean, I just think that that's incredible.
It was truly, truly incredible.
Truly an incredible time.
And wow. Also...
I mean, beautiful. Oh, yes. And also, welcome to Why Are You Like This? Welcome. Sister Wives Edition.
I fucking wish, but it's got enough... There's enough shows that I already listen to.
That's the ticket.
And remember, the greatest myth about the moon is that America went there in Apollo 11. Good night. Yes. Good night.
Next week on Blood Magic Menstruation, the podcast.
I love that we just Me Too'd God.
It's franchising our platform. We're franchising it, okay?
They're going to break your legs and feed you to the sharks.
Yeah, people don't care how many times Dan Brown says that book was a work of fiction. I'm saying.
Well, we've brought it back to blood magic somehow.
I hope you finger blast every time you listen to this podcast. That's just a light good suggestion. For you. Pairs well with finger blasting. Okay?
Seeking Sister Wife? No, that's a show. That's a great show on TLC.
Listen, Why Are You Like This is the weekly podcast where sometimes we talk about the sister wives. Jamie peppers it in when she can. But we really just noodle on, dissect, discuss, you know, pop culture, pseudoscience, real science, human behavior, whatever we're noodling on at any given time in order to determine why people are the way that they are. That is Jamie Ryan picking sides because she never meant to do more than this in Los Angeles.
And that's Austin Williams, who should know that husband Cody Brown and sister wife Mary Brown, their birthdays are only one day apart, but never once do we see Mary's birthday celebrated on camera.
Oh.
And that's who should know that? Austin Williams should know that in Chicago.
I'm upset about that in Chicago. Jeez. Man.
They're always like, we're doing this for Cody's birthday. Oh my God, Cody's birthday. We all have to do something for Cody's birthday. And when I looked up for astrological reasons, all of their birthdays.
Obviously. Obviously. Our resident numerologist, non-astrologer, Jamie.
I was like, this bitch, it's her birthday too. Like, what?
You're like literally their birthdays are separated by seconds. And yet here we are.
Here we are. But astrologically, this is the last thing I'll say about the Brown family. It's fascinating because Mary and Cody like hate the things about each other that they hate about themselves. And they're too similar. And that's a big problem. And I'll just say like their charts are probably fucking identical.
Don't you think that's like really like a thing for most people though? Like,
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, with that said, I mean, I actually am coming to this blind because I'm telling you what we're not talking about, but I don't know what we're talking about.
We are tonight, as we sometimes say in the open, we are franchising it. And by that, I mean, we are going to talk about TGI Fridays, the beloved restaurant chain.
I mean, listen, y'all, you thought we were kidding when we did a whole episode exclusively about Chick-fil-A. But if you were around for that one, I would think that you're jazzed about the fact that this is an episode about another chain restaurant.
It means that there's more. There's more meat on that bone, so to speak.
I to be honest, I don't know any hot goss about TGI Fridays. And I can't wait for you to spill the tea, okay?
Amazing. So before we get into the history, we'll spend some time later. The meat of the episode we'll spend with the founder of TGI Fridays. But first, I just want to share that due to a custody arrangement in the 90s, I often found myself in a TGI Fridays on Wednesday evenings.
Sure. Seems like a place that, you know... Dads folks in those arrangements might take their children.
Yeah. And also for many, many birthday dinners with my grandparents. And my order was only ever a Shirley Temple.
Also, for the record, you and a dear friend of ours in college used to say, do you want to go to the library? And that meant you were going to TGI Fridays to split an appetizer and a dessert.
And we would yeah, sit at the bar at like 5 p.m., sometimes get a drink, sometimes not, and do just that. And we might go into Half Price Books after, but we're going home and putting our pajamas on. Yeah, sounds like a great day. Anyway, just to share with you what my order was every single time, it was a Shirley Temple Inn chicken fingers meal with extra, extra honey mustard. And I have to say that their honey mustard recipe was a dragon that I would chase for years and years trying to replicate it. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have one? Do you feel like you've achieved nirvana?
I feel like Chick-fil-A sauce kind of replaced that and then figured out how to
Isn't Chick-fil-A sauce just like a blend of all of their condiments?
That's a rumor, I think. You can make one at home that's pretty similar.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, but so like Fridays now obviously has like a different flavor to me than it had in our youth. Like I kind of like associate it with like Applebee's, which I guess was different in our youth also, but it used to be like more fancy or like more acceptable to go to Fridays.
It's back when we were like still like going to the Olive
exactly
Garden, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you get dressed up to go to the Olive Garden. It is an appropriate like I hate to say this, but it was the times, I guess, father-daughter dance. I know people went there before that sometimes.
Oh, yeah, feels right.
That wasn't something I participated in, but others were doing it. Anyway, obviously we all experienced the decline of chain restaurants through the food explosion era of the last, like, 15 or so years, where we no longer, like, think of Fridays on Fridays. You feel me?
I do feel you, and I just want to say, on this note of chain restaurants, as a payment for... Listen, I did a lot of cleaning and physical labor, and my boyfriend, as a result, to show me gratitude, because I had been talking earlier in the day about how much I love Don Pablo's, my favorite chain restaurant.
Yep, I worked
and
there.
Right, exactly. I talked about how you got whipped. But I was like, yeah, fucking. And I said, and she still fucking ate there. That's how good it is. I ate it like 9 out of 10 times after chemotherapy. I was like, I'd finish being like pumped full of drugs.
I'd eat it tomorrow.
I'd be like, Mom, I'd be like, just go pick up some chicken enchiladas at the Don. It's the only thing I want. That's true. I would like house some chips and salsa.
Sounds fucking
and
great.
And we used to go there in college and just eat the free chips and salsa and throw back a few Coronas. But all to say, he had never heard of Don Pablo's because they don't have those in his hometown. And he took me when he understood what, to the best of his ability, what a Don Pablo's was.
Sure.
At some point impromptu later that day, he drove me to a place called Rosalita's Cantina. And he loudly played the Bruce Springsteen song Rosalita in the parking lot. And then we entered and I housed some queso. And he was like, is this the vibe? And I was like, this place is 100% just like suburb Don Pablo energy. And you understand me.
That's amazing.
He also said that when we sat down and I ordered queso, it was the happiest he had seen me look in months.
Sometimes you just need a queso and that's fine. Just a mid-level Midwest queso.
I'm sorry, I digress too much on this queso story, but I wanted to get my own chain restaurant plug in selfishly.
That's fine. And I did work at Don Pablo's. I did not ever work at Fridays, but I did apply and interview there in high school, but I was not.
And didn't get the job.
I was not old enough. They told me that I could just bus or that I could host. And I was like, no. I'm here to serve her.
I'm
not here at all.
Money.
Yeah.
Then you went and worked at Big Boy. Okay.
It was after Big Boy. Come on.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Listen.
Guys,
Jamie's had some good serving experience. That's all to say. And shame on you, Fridays. You missed out on a good one.
You did. I could have made you the standard money you were already making. Anyway. I'm not an upseller in any way. I refuse to upsell. I've had many a fight with managers about that. But that time has passed. Anyway. We're going to get back into Fridays, where I don't and never have worked. So
TGI, okay.
Rather than me narrating the history of TGI Fridays, as I might in other episodes, Bobby Fischer, whatnot, we're going to spend some time with the founder by way of, I'd like to read through some portions of an interview with, his name is Alan Stillman. Sorry, Alan Stillman, single still, not multiple.
Okay. All right.
And
welcome to the program, Alan.
I want to say, as we go through this, pauses and questions and discussions throughout are encouraged.
I'll be here.
Because this is like truly an incredible journey into the past. Like there are, you'll see, it touches on many things that I was like, just a little.
I have no idea how old the restaurant is either, like when it started. So I'm excited to know like what eras we'll be dancing through.
I thought it was probably like an 80s creation or like an early 90s, but.
Seems like.
It was not. So.
Much older. Okay.
Heads up, Alan, because he's our narrator, like he is mostly reliable, but he's definitely like eccentric and like self-aggrandizing as a narrator.
Okay, sure, perfect.
So yeah. There's that. So we're going to be working from a 2010 article from Edible Geography that is an
Wow, just the fact that there's a site called Edible Geography, go on, could be our new third favorite resource on the podcast.
And this is an expansion of an interview from the New City Reader's food edition. And I know that's confusing, but I am once again trying to do the thing where I cite a source without telling you the title until later because it's I don't want the reveal that the title gives.
Well, that is exciting. Okay.
So this is an interview that was conducted by Nicola, who is the author of this article. And also the interview was also conducted by architect Krista Ninivagi. Sorry about that pronunciation.
God bless you.
So they talked to Alan for the New City Reader. And the year was 1965, since he doesn't say that up top when we're walking into this.
We haven't been to the moon yet, listening.
We have not, but NASA does exist because Jack Parsons is already dead. Anyway, so New City Reader asks, what's the story behind TGI Fridays? And Alan says, I lived on 63rd Street between 1st Street and York. Easy access to the 59th Street Bridge meant you could get out of New York quickly. So that meant that in the two or three blocks of that neighborhood, there was a pile of airline stewardesses. And for whatever reason, there was also a whole bunch of models. Basically, a lot of single people all live between 60th and 65th and between York and 3rd Avenue. It seemed to me that the best way to meet girls was to open up a bar. And so he's
basically... I do admire that as like a vibe.
Well, and it's interesting. I never thought about like that people who need to leave the city quickly, such as people who work at airports, like would all like probably live near each other. Like relative income jobs probably fill that up and you do end up with a bunch of single people. Anyway, there's not as many neighborhoods like that now, but here we go. And they ask, where were those people hanging out before you opened your bar? And so this is implying that these people are eventually going to make their way to Alan's place, but we'll get to that later. So.
Oh, I bet we will.
We will. Alan says, at the time, the way that you met people, it was all cocktail parties. And this is wild to me. Brief pause. So.
Okay.
I don't really know anything about like 50s and 60s cocktail party culture, aside from like a little bit of Mad Men and like a couple of movies that might have had like a cocktail party scene.
Yeah, that feels right. I mean, that's like, I feel like what I know.
But like, it was a much bigger deal than I ever realized. So he says, what would happen is that on Wednesday and Thursday, you'd start collecting information. Things like, oh, on Friday night at 8 o'clock at 415 East 63rd Street, there's going to be a great party run by three airline stewardesses. Then somebody else would say, well, I got a good one. It's going to be run by one of those baseball players at his apartment. And basically, you build up a cocktail list and you bounce from one place to the other. Cocktail parties were wild, by the way, but there was no public place.
I bet they were.
I bet they were, too. But there was no public place for people between, say, 23 to 37 years old to meet. So they're all just inside at these cocktail parties. That seems like the most unsafe thing ever, but I don't know.
I mean, it doesn't seem great.
No. So then they say, and I was obviously thinking this, but like, what about other bars? And they specifically cite PJ Clark's, which is just like a standard, like very, very old bar in New York. And
okay.
Alan tells us PJ Clark's was there. It had been existence in existence for forever, but it wasn't a meeting place. It was a guy's beer drinking hangout, and there were very few women there. That was pretty typical of the New York bar scene at the time. And brief pause, because I listened to some other shit about the history of Fridays and like a little bit about the history of bar culture. And while women were not officially banned from bars, they really like weren't, it was not like socially acceptable for women to be in bars. And there was like, this is more true for women of color than white women, but
for sure,
could happen for any woman. There's a like pretty high chance that if you're a woman in a bar alone, that even if you're not intoxicated, you might end up with vice or at the time prostitution charges. I don't know if it's still called that. Just for being there. So a lot of bars had like no women allowed rules.
I mean, that sucks.
It does suck indeed. And I, this is again why it's like impossible to be a lesbian back in the day. It's just like, how would you ever find each other?
Yeah, it's actually like not, it seems not super feasible. And like, what a bummer.
I know. Our hidden history, more and more will be revealed as time goes on. Anyway, we're not here to talk about lesbians.
We could be.
We could be. We could talk about, yeah, we'll talk about maybe a little bit of queer stuff at the end, just in a thought experiment kind of way. But
sure.
Stillman has got a straight bar in his mind. He's looking to meet the ladies. So he says, the other thing is that in creating TGI Fridays, my timing was exquisite because I opened Fridays the exact year that the pill was invented.
He is a little self-aggrandizing. He's like, I have done it.
He, well, and
birth
yes.
control.
I happened to hit the sexual revolution on the head. And the result was that, without really intending it, I became the founder of the first singles bar. And that is what I think is self-aggrandizing.
Well, for sure. I'm like, okay, buddy. Like,
so I did want to fact check him a little bit. So I was just like, did some light Googling. And I was like, what is considered the first singles bar? And it's a lot of hits about Fridays come up, if I'm totally honest.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's like other bar in New York that I saw that was around the same time. It was like in the mid 60s as well. So who knows? I don't, Alan, you know, I'm looking at you sideways, but I do seem to like you. It's fine.
Looking at you, Alan.
He seems to have a certain charm, and I'll share a photo with you later of him.
Okay.
You won't be attracted to him the way you're attracted to Jack Parsons, so don't worry about that.
Well, I know. That was upsetting to me. Jack Parsons is kind of hot. He's like my type.
I know. Even he's not my type, but I understand.
Can appreciate the hotness.
Yeah, like his charm and kind of wry sensuality. I don't know. But then he also looks like this person that I used to work with who I really think is annoying. And so that ruins it.
I mean, that'll do it.
It'll do it. Okay, back to Alan. So he's just claimed to have created the first ever singles bar the moment that the pill was invented, which, of course, like, is great for business. If there was nowhere for all these horny people to go except into each other's apartments under the cover of darkness.
Except into these people's horny arms.
Exactly. So let's put those horny arms in public, is what Alan said.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So he says, the reason that it happened is that I used to stop into this corner bar near where I lived, a dirty old First Avenue bar with a bullet hole in the window called the Good Tavern.
Oh,
and you know, who knows, he could be sensationalizing, but also maybe.
I mean, maybe that's just what he remembers. Maybe that's why he thought it was cool when he was young.
This is true. He says, I used to talk to the bartender. I would say to him, you know, you ought to change the decor in here to something with it. It would be a great place for all these people around here to meet each other. Eventually, he said, why don't you do it? And I have to say, as a person who worked service for a long time, that it does become tiring and grating when like a regular guest comes in and is consistently telling a bartender or a server what should be changed about like the atmosphere of the restaurant.
I mean, I would hate that person.
Because just like, I'm exhausted. What are you doing? I can't change that. And all this man says to him is, why don't you do it? Anyway, Alan thinks he's a genius, and maybe he is, but just $5,000 later, I had bought the premises with a short lease, and I was off and running. And actually, brief pause, I'll cut the Googling, but I need to look up what $5,000 in 1965 is in today's money.
Oh, yeah.
That is the equivalent of about $44,500 for a bar in New York to be leased and for a business to go up and running. So obviously it is much more challenging to do this now, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
Okay, so after he tells them about like that he purchases this bar where he was like a pretty irritating regular, authors of the article ask him to explain how he went about recreating that cocktail party atmosphere in a public space. And he doesn't specifically talk about this, I don't think, but the first thing that I thought of was like the food at Fridays actually like does reflect a like a 70s or like a sorry an earlier probably 50s or 60s cocktail party. It's like
say more
finger food, like mozzarella sticks, like potato skins, like club sandwiches. It's all
I can get down with this. That does feel kind of right. I never thought about the menus of like a Fridays or an Applebee's kind of being like that. But yeah, I kind of feel that.
And since there were no bar restaurants before this, there wasn't like a menu kind of like totally like that before. You could go to a diner and get a burger, or you could go like get drinks at a bar if you were a man. But there wasn't really like a place where you would have just like appetizers and cocktails. That's like not a thing.
Except at
people's houses, yeah, which I wish we'd all do more at each other's houses. Please invite me to
anytime anybody
party.
I had a Friday the 13th party one time where everybody came over for cocktails and french fries.
Yes,
and it was on Friday the 13th, and I spelled the party F-R-Y day, so you're welcome.
Thank you. I'd love to attend.
One of my better
time.
Moves.
Yeah, give me like 6 months heads up. Okay, so yep. Alan's gonna explain, since he forgets about the food. He forgets that the food came from the cocktail parties, but I knew. Anyway, Alan says,
you knew.
All I really did was throw sawdust on the floor and hang up fake Tiffany lamps. I painted the building blue, and I put the waiters in red and white striped soccer shirts. If you think that I know, right? I'm like, okay, so it's from the beginning.
I'm like, that's right.
Do you remember their mascot on the kids menu when we were kids was like this little zebra that had red stripes instead of black stripes?
I don't remember this at all, but okay.
Yeah. Anyway, back to this. He says, if you think that I knew what I was doing, you're dead wrong. I had no training in the restaurant business or interior design or architecture. I just have a feel.
I mean, that doesn't really surprise me.
I know. I just have a feel for how to use all those things to create an experience.
Yeah, that's right.
I wanted TGI Fridays to feel like a neighborhood corner bar where you could get a good hamburger, good french fries.
Welcome to Fridays. Okay.
And feel comfortable. At the same time, it was a sophisticated hamburger and fry place. Apparently, I invented the idea of serving burgers on toasted English muffin. But the principle involved was to make people feel that they were going to someone's apartment for a cocktail party.
I'm listening.
The food eventually played a larger role than I'd imagined it would, because a lot of the girls didn't have enough money to stretch from one paycheck to the other. So I became the purveyor of free hamburgers at the end of the month. So if you were a lady in 1965, you could get some free burgers at Fridays. Anyway, who knows what you'd have to do for them.
Tight.
Just probably like a wink and a smile, maybe a butt tap. We're not sure.
I mean, I don't love that part, but I am open to the other parts.
Well, it's interesting why this happens. So he says, I don't think there was anything else like it at the time. Before TGI Fridays, four single 25-year-old girls were not going to go out on Friday nights in public and with each other to have a good time. They went to people's apartments for cocktail parties, or they might go to a real restaurant for a date or for somebody's birthday, but they weren't going out with each other to a bar or for a casual dinner and drinks because there was no such place for them to go. And so all of a sudden, these women are spending money that they have never spent money like on like dinners this way, it seems like.
Right.
So they're running out. It took off extraordinarily quickly. In the first 6 to 9 months, TGI Fridays got written up in Time, Newsweek, and the Saturday Evening Post. Then Maxwell's Plum opened across the street, which was another singles bar. It was really quite a phenomenon.
Is this about to be Max and Irma's origin story?
I don't think so, but...
Wouldn't it be funny if?
But let's, again, do a quick Google that I will cut. No, different from Max and Irma's. Maxwell's Plum opened in 1966 and closed in 1988. Not recently, seems like.
We'll see. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. So not Max and Irma's, although once I was served some chicken there that had clearly been fried in the fish fryer, and I was very upset.
I mean, someone had to be upset by that.
Someone had to be upset. So he tells us that he believes that the first line of the history of bars, restaurant, and discos may have been at TGI Fridays. And by that, he means like the line outside. So like the first time that like a club or a restaurant or anywhere like has a line outside, like he thinks.
I mean, is there evidence supporting that? Because that would be crazy if it's true.
It would be crazy. That's not super Googleable because like the whole world has club. I don't know. I feel like there's probably a club in Europe that had, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Some kind of discotheque. Anyway, he thinks that he invented the line. So he's going to tell us how he invents the line. He says that...
I'm open to it, though, honestly.
Inside of 3 months, we had to hire a doorman. One night I was tending bar and he walked... Oh, and he also like bartended for like the first 3 years or something most nights. So he's like living this super intense lifestyle doing that and also being the owner and like fucking a ton of girls that come in.
I mean, just seems, you know, like an energy.
It does. So he says, one night while I was tending bar, he walked up to me, the doorman, and said, "Listen, there's a dozen people standing outside and we have no tables and no room at the bar. What do you want me to do?" And this seems very straightforward to me, but I guess if there was no such thing as lines, you wouldn't know. So Alan says, "I tell you what, why don't you just tell them to wait? And when someone comes out, you'll let them in." He said that he didn't know whether they would wait or not. And I said I didn't know what else to tell him. And so he went back. Next thing you know, I come out from behind the bar to get something and I look outside and there were 40 people standing in line. The next week, we ended up buying velvet ropes because of course he did. There was nothing like that anywhere else. You would either...
I mean, maybe that had happened somewhere else or maybe it hadn't, but like...
Maybe not still in New York like at the time.
Yeah, I mean, still very ball. I would kind of, if it, you know, I don't know, shit like that starts in New York. But I'm like very ballsy to throw that out as like an early adopter. Because if you think about it now, that people like would never like wait outside to get in somewhere. Like that hadn't really been like seen or normalized yet. Mm-hmm. That's actually like kind of a big ask.
Yes. And I'm kind of like into maybe the idea of going back to a world where we don't normalize 90 minute waits. Maybe we find another restaurant. I don't know. But
I mean, I'm too old to wait in line for a lot of things these days. Not everything, but a lot of things.
Not everything, but a lot of things. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that you're right, because even like not being from LA means that I have a lower tolerance for waiting in lines than people who are from here.
Mm.
So, yeah, he concludes by saying, like, normally before he invented the line and normalized it, that you would either have a reservation at a fancy restaurant or you would just go into a bar or a diner. Like you said, like you would really just change your night, just like pivot.
Yeah.
So... I guess you're welcome a million other establishments for Alan's good work there.
Mm-hmm.
So they ask him, "What else did you have to introduce or change in those early months?" Stillman says,
"What else did you have to change?"
I think they're trying to get him to be like, "I learned this," or like, "This thing right, I did right. didn't work immediately." But I don't know. Maybe it all did. Anyway, so he says, "We had to change the way we ran the place completely. It was a long bar with bar stools, and I don't think anyone expected there to be people standing four deep behind the stools. Straight away, we went from one bartender to three. The waiters couldn't get through the aisles of the crowd, so we had to adjust where the seating was. They re-geared the menu completely. They changed the way the food's coming out of the kitchen, the order of things." Basically, just he describes learning how to run a restaurant, like a fairly normal learning curve.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess
he's never worked in a restaurant before.
And the it seems like I it does. I don't know. I'm not trying to be too like Team Alan, but if there really weren't places like this, I'm like, yeah, that must have been a very different vibe.
This is true, but I would think that probably the tables would be the same distance apart as like the tables at a regular restaurant. But it's cool. That's fine.
He figured it out. I don't know. Like when you think about like the like a true club situation versus like here's the spot where like everyone like comes in with their older families to eat dinner. It is just a different vibe.
Mm-hmm. And high tops are spaced differently. Okay. Okay. I'm with you. All right. So Alan says that inside of 18 months, two more places opened up within a block. By the summer of 1965, the police had to come along, put up barriers, and close First Avenue between 63rd and 64th Street on Friday nights from 8 p.m. until midnight because there were so many kids going back and forth between these bars that the cars couldn't get through. They made it a pedestrian road. I want that.
They made it a pedestrian road that because of the bar.
Just from 8 to midnight. There's too many fucked up people in the street. Wow. I think normalize that. I don't know why that didn't get normalized through all of this. Good, good work. So they ask him, did your strategy work? Did you meet good looking girls? And then
I mean probably, and he was like, I own the place. Like,
well, yeah. And I listened to an interview with the guy who was a partner later when they started franchising, and he said that he would just go in
franchise it. I'm sorry. It's my own catchphrase, just getting it in there.
He would go in to Fridays on Friday and Saturday night and just stand by a girl that he thought was hot. And when she looked at him, he said that this pickup line worked every time. He would just say, I own the place. And then that would be that, apparently. So you're right. People are doing it. But
I mean, listen, people be out here.
Alan tells us, have you seen the movie Cocktail? Tom Cruise played me. Let that sink in.
Wait, is that true?
I don't think so. I don't think there's like legit evidence for that. But
I mean, I don't know the movie Cocktail, so
let's check what his name is. There's a lot of side stuff going on here.
No, it's not. It's he plays a Haywood Gould. Student named Brian Flanagan
is the real person. Oh no. Okay. He did not really. I think that the sentiment, the sort of brand of truth that Stillman is telling is that he was one of the first kind of celebrity adjacent bartenders. And
sure. That it was. I kind of want to watch this movie now, though, called Cocktail, and I don't even like Tom Cruise. So,
have you never heard of Cocktail?
No, I've never heard of it.
I feel like you would like it because I just feel like it's from like an era of movies that you like. And I don't know if I'm just thinking of Top Gun, but I don't know.
You it's guys, fun, I love it's Top flashy. Gun, and you like Top Fast Gun and Furious. 2 comes out on my birthday, and I've never felt more seen by the universe.
Yeah, except that I was baptized but on your birthday. Never forget.
Jamie's birthday.
In the Lord.
In the Lord is my birthday on the planet. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, back to this. So Alan is saying that Tom Cruise played him. He says, I was lucky enough to do it for 3 years. He only did it to make a movie. In today, the advantage of being the guy behind the bar is, or even today, the advantage of being the guy behind the bar is huge. Why do girls want to date the bartender? To this day, I'm not sure I get it. So,
I mean, I do. Go ahead.
He's being showy and he's getting a lot of puss. Yeah, that's what's happening. Yeah, so
listen.
Then they go on to say, you opened up 12 TGI Fridays in total. How did you make the transformation from bar owner to businessman? So we're getting into
that
franchise.
Is a good question.
Yes, that's a totally different animal. And also he's been like bartending this whole time. I don't know. I just can't imagine. That's such an intense life. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Alan says, first of all, I'll bet you Fridays spawned 30 to 40 restaurants and bars. We hired young people with bartending and waiting experience, and they made a lot of money, and a lot of them went out and opened up their own places. So a lot of the franchise owners in the early years for Fridays were former employees who saved like tip money and eventually became an owner. But in the second actual TGI Fridays, the second actual location was in Memphis, Tennessee. I didn't pick it. They picked me. The original bar was 2 years old and it had national recognition at some point. Somebody came in and said, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and I own a shopping area down there with room for one of these. Will you sell me a franchise? I have to admit, I didn't know what the word franchise meant. So I said, if you have...
I mean, I appreciate that.
I do too. So I said, if you have the money, I'll be the partner and I'll show you how to do it and we'll split it 50-50. We shook hands and a year and a half later, we opened a TGI Fridays in Memphis. So second location is Memphis.
I don't know what a good rate for a franchise is, but 50-50 either, it sounds to me like it's either great or terrible.
I don't know. I really don't know what you get into in a franchise, like how much of a partner you truly are. This seems like a lot of autonomy to me based on things that I've heard about franchising, but I really don't truly know.
There you go.
So he says people started coming in there from Little Rock and Nashville. So this is a travel destination now. And more guys walking in wanted to partner with me. So I did the same thing again. Before I knew it, I had 5 or 6 TGI Fridays around the country. But it wasn't pre-planned at all. So this really just happened organically.
To Jai's.
And it's kind of like the first... There is no Ruby Tuesdays yet. There is no Applebee's.
Goodbye,
like
Ruby Tuesday. Who could put a name on you?
Then.
I'm sorry. I take it back.
Then a couple of guys came in from Texas, and this is where things are going to get a little different. They said, we want to do this in Texas, and we want to do it at, of course, 5 times the size.
It would.
On 3 floors, they did for the very first time a square bar in the center, which now is like very much the Fridays, like, and I think usually like Ruby Tuesdays model for the bar. And
yeah, and Applebee's and all sorts of places.
Mm-hmm. And so that was the first location to do that of this kind of like first kind of restaurant. And what they said was so incredible about that was this is still when it's like, maybe 50% like singles bar kind of vibes. And
okay,
people loved the square bar because you could look
you
at
could
people
see across.
So like infinitely hot. More like hookups and like
hot.
Sexual energy exchange and just like
hot.
Being able to scope people out. Like it's a totally different animal once you have a square
bar.
Wow.
Okay. I'm going to be honest. Like what, like, I want someone to ask me at like in a social situation, be like, what's the horniest shaped bar? And I'd be like, let me
square.
Actually tell you about this. Square, a circle or something like that. But it's
something
none
in
of
the
this
round.
Straight line. Yeah, that's right. Something, a bar in the round, the horniest bar of all.
They had a lot of money and a lot of business expertise. And soon enough, we were in Houston and Dallas and on it went. So... they ask, did changing the size of the restaurant change the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, of course.
Stillman says, the size didn't change as much as our expansion into the big suburban towns. Those cities have a very different way of interacting with the street in the first place. But the big shift was that during the day, we started to get families. So you're moving from a New York street corner where like people are walking by and like young people are coming at night to being like near shopping centers in Memphis.
Mm-hmm,
in like the center of a parking lot. So we had very informal, casual food. You could get an omelet or a hamburger. So families were coming in with their kids. It seems weird to get an omelet at Fridays. Whatever.
I guess
they don't serve breakfast.
Like, yeah, that's weird. Yeah, I guess that's true.
I don't know. That was a big change. They started doing kids'
omelets,
food.
Omelets, though, are like not exclusively breakfast food in different parts.
It depends. Yeah, that's true. That's true. He says it took 6 or 7 years for this to happen, but eventually Fridays became a very different animal. And so by the early 70s, like, it's really switched over from, like, a place where women, like, go immediately after they take their birth control to, like, a place where people come with their families in the afternoon or for their child's birthday. So.
Interesting.
By 1971, the economy was very bad, to which I say asterisk, asterisk, asterisk.
At the, right.
At the time, but you know that everything's relative. They didn't know. At the time, we had a dozen Fridays and we were trying to open up three more. By then, everyone was chasing us. There was Somebody Tuesdays and Bennigan's and this thing and that thing. And you needed big money.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think about like TGI Fridays and then Ruby Tuesdays being like literally a response.
I know. And I love that he said Somebody Tuesdays.
He's like, I'm not even giving you this coverage. Somebody Tuesday. That's hilarious.
Well, yeah, I believe it still exists, so he probably like doesn't want to. And you needed big money to do it right and open three this year and five the next and 10 the year after that. And I didn't want to sell out, but I didn't not want to either. And I feel that.
I respect that, honestly. Listen, it's like, I don't want to sell out, but like also I'm not trying to like not sell out, you know.
Like, he's like, listen, I opened a swinging singles bar when I was in my youth, and now I'm looking down the barrel of this never-ending opening of family franchises around the country, and I don't know if I want it anymore.
We'll franchise it.
Yeah, and he sure did. But
that's his platform.
While we were trying to raise the money to expand, someone came to me and offered me enough money. With $1 million at the time, you could retire and do nothing for the rest of your life. So I sold. And he doesn't say how much it was, but just reminds us that like a million meant a lot more at the time and that he is rich.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That's a reminder.
So then he really bows out of Fridays. Like, he takes the money and he creates another restaurant called Smith and Walensky. Had you ever heard of that?
Mm-mm.
I had not heard of this either. He kind of like follows his own same model where he opens a location in New York and then after that starts expanding around the country. And he feels that he gets much better at like opening multiple locations through Smith and Walensky because he like comes to learn like a very specific set of needs for like where he can open them. And really he starts to learn that like having multiple restaurants is like very much a real estate game. And so he goes on in the article.
Well, that's true.
Very much. And how like franchising has really become a real estate game. And so the iteration of TGI Fridays that we know, Stillman like birthed it, but he really never had a part of it. So it was just like this different like purchased corporate machine like by the time it got to us. And I'm like so interested in its like original flavor. And this is a thing that I would check out if I had the ability to go in the past. Just if anyone was wondering, one of those things.
I mean, yeah, I was wondering, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. But so this article, the Smith and Walensky stuff is like not interesting. But if you, dear listener, are more interested in it, go for it. He tells you about his son's restaurant and how he doesn't understand young people culture. But of course he doesn't. And you should open restaurants that are for your peers because you'll understand it. And that's great advice. But anyway, there are a number of comments on the article. So this is just one of many comments like this. And I think that it's like so sweet and it reminds me of my grandmother. And it like makes me realize how long ago this was and that like the people who were in the original TGI Fridays are like in their 70s and 80s. So like the way that they interact with the internet is like it even though I'm picturing them as a young person, it's written like as though my grandma has written it. And that's that's fun. So I just wanted to read you this comment from Neil Coslow. He says, met my wife 44 years on Thanksgiving Eve 1967. Went to NYC after a televised Nick Road game. I had seen my future wife, Eileen, twice before, once at Fridays and another time at a bar on First Avenue and 75th called the Jet Set. Both times she was on a Friday night date. This was unheard of at the time. The third time she was accompanied by her best friend Susan and her neighbor, the driver, my friend Phil. He was playing wingman. She gave me her number because she could wear big girl shoes, she being 5'10 and me 6'3. It's just like the weird details like written in the way my grandma would write them in.
I love it though.
And then he says, we married in Lindsay's snowstorm, I don't know what that is, on February 15th, 1969. the day after Valentine's Day for half-price flowers and chocolates. The third.
This really is your grandparents' era, though, because they were in it in 1969. So go ham.
Exactly. The third time was a charm. Dot dot. So many dot dot dots. More to tell. Dot 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 dot. Would love to connect this and more to Mr. Stillman, Neil Coslow, neilcos@yahoo.com. He would like Stillman to email him.
Oh,
I love that.
It's wholesome.
I know. But then there's another woman, Linda Goldstein. She lived in Manhattan in the 60s. Fridays was her favorite hangout. She says, I was one of those young women who fell in love with the bartender. And I even remember the guy's name, Carl.
Go off, Linda Goldstein. Get you some, girl.
I still can't figure out what made them such a sexy draw card. But I guess the psychology of it can be explained by the right people. The guy in charge of who gets drinks and wine, when, etc. Ha. I now live in Brisbane, Australia, and guess what? There's a TGIF here. Very well done interviewing Mr. Stillman. Seems generous.
Seems generous.
But I just love that, like, so there are so many. I'm not going to read them all because they're just things like that. Then like, you don't want to hear all those, but just like there are.
I kind of do want to hear them all. It's wholesome.
Do you want like one more? Let me.
Yeah, I kind of do. Go ahead. Bring me another one.
This is from Phil Hankins. My history with TGIF began in the Little Rock store just a few months after it opened. I also worked in Memphis and Nashville and even went to New York for a month for further enhanced training. Quote, when Fridays moved to Dallas, I was on the first traveling team of bartenders. I worked in many other stores, Houston, Indianapolis, Atlanta, Tampa, Phoenix, Los Angeles, Portland, and more. My career ended in Honolulu. I remember the names like Vic Smith, the original head bartender, Rush Bowman, who spun the first bottle, whatever that means.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Did spin the bottle originate at TGI Fridays?
Or maybe they were like the originators of like bartender tricks when they were like spinning bottles.
Oh, it probably was things like that. Then he goes on to name a few more people. Frank Steed, who eventually became CEO. He was originally the doorman at the Memphis store when I first met him. So this guy was in like ground level, every store.
Yeah, he was like, listen, I'm out here with these franchises.
And I love that the doorman from the Memphis store eventually became the CEO. Get it? Maybe there's some opportunity in franchises from time to time in the past. Anyway, he says it was quite an adventure for a young single man in his 20s and 30s. Thank you, Alan, for giving me the opportunity and for these memories and the education on restauranting and how popular bartenders can be with single women. I never got it either. Wow. I'm glad we read another one.
I seem like so surprised by that as somebody who, you know, listen.
It's a person who's on stage, kind of.
Yeah, I don't know why we're confused about the hotness of bartenders. I feel like just like keenly aware of it.
I know. I think it's a generational thing. I think maybe because these men first began drinking when women weren't in bars and it was like a very different atmosphere, they might be like, why do you give a fuck about the person who's pouring the drinks?
I do, though.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so if you want to look into more of that on your own, go ahead. That's going to be on ediblegeography.com. And to finally give credit where credit's due, the article is called A Cocktail Party in the Street, an Interview with Alan Stillman. And I just didn't want to say it right away up front because I thought it was such like an interesting reveal that like the whole restaurant is kind of built around like feeling like a cocktail party because like that's the only place women could like really drink without being hassled.
I mean, I think that that's, I like this. In some ways, like, he was a part of empowering women in a, like, a way to, like, go out like the dudes a little bit.
Yes. And there is another, like, women's, like, drinking rights movement that, like, maybe we should do a different episode on sometime. But women fighting for the right to drink alongside men in bars and public without being arrested.
I've been fighting for it personally my whole life.
I know that you have. I know.
Thank you. Means a lot.
And I just keep thinking like that it would be so fun to like have an idea like this, to like see a hole in the market and for under $50,000 be able to like execute. And so I just have to say that like the business landscape of mid-century America for the white male was like truly a playground of access and business loans. And I'm kind of,
I mean, it's so crazy. I'm truly jealous. A playground.
Yeah, a playground. And I also wanted to follow up on if anyone wanted more information about women's drinking in public, you can go to daily.jstor.org/no-unescorted-ladies-will-be-served. And there is some good info there that I will probably cover another time, but it's what I used to fact check Alan saying that women weren't allowed to drink in public. So that's where all that
is. I mean, I did know about that being a thing because I've thought about it when people are like, what decade would you want to go back in time in? And I'm like, I'm a woman. Probably not. Like, I mean, I don't even think we have to like get to the 70s for me to not be able to have my own bank account. Like,
no. Yeah, it's yep. You're fucked. You're fucked before like 1995.
I'm not interested. I'm not interested in these shitty times.
No. I think it's the Clinton years are after. And also when people ask you about picking a time period, it's like, can I also pick my location or am I here wherever I am now?
Yeah, that's true too. That is true too.
Yeah. Anyway, so to continue to ground this in what was going on, so obviously this is very like straight culture thing. We talked about like women not being able to go out and like get their juicy flirt on in the bars, but there were obviously bars for men and there were queer bars. Those of course had always been like fairly underground though, so I don't know if that like counts. And those were frequently raided by the police. And for like timing context, the Stonewall Uprising was in 1969, so just 4 years after Fridays opened. So all of this like bar and restaurant stuff is like really exploding in New York, like around the like mid-60s to mid-70s.
Wow. I think that's very cool. I'm like very happy to know that, honestly. It's interesting to me.
Well, and we witnessed in our lifetime definitely like a culinary boom or like the sort of changing of the guard or something.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like it feels on par with like the digital revolution. Like we also had like a food revolution. And this feels like the one before, like that I didn't know about. Because I'm always like, what are all these mid-level restaurants like Ruby Tuesdays, Fridays, Applebee's, like fucking Chili's? Like, what? Like, when did that happen? Like, who did that? And I think that we may have found our answer to who did that and when did it happen.
Do you know what? That's actually a very like important and essential.
It is important. Yeah.
I'm like, man, who influenced my culture this way?
We wouldn't have the frozen appetizers that we currently have without Alan.
That is true. And wow, you know what? Listen, I love a good persnickety review of a tasting menu, but don't come for me if you don't want to get down with a mozzarella stick, okay?
Yeah, I had some
potato skin, extra sour cream.
Very, very disappointing potato skins from Trader Joe's this week.
Wait, what does that even mean? Trader Joe's usually slaps. What did they do?
Just like occasionally you'll get an item at Trader Joe's. It's like, yeah, you don't get that one, you know? Like there's the three cheese pizza tastes artificial, but the four cheese pizza tastes regular. But with the potato skins, and other people think that too. You can look that up online. The potato skins were so thick and dry, like just all just dry potato, so starchy.
I mean, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, and not a lot of toppings. Anyway, get other things in the frozen aisle at Trader Joe's. I'm going to connect
this. Trader Joe's wouldn't even exist. Or the Friday's branded potato skins at your local, you know, Kroger's, King Super, Mariana's, Fred Meyer, wherever the fuck you're shopping regionally. Wow. Just.
Also, the potato chips that they made of those.
Yeah, I never liked those.
I love those with the orange dust all over them. I love cheat. Yeah.
Always, it's not for me. Always love cheat. I respect it.
Thank you. But yeah, I think even the, like, I don't know if Trader Joe's would look the same if Fridays hadn't, I mean, someone would have invented, like, frozen appetizers, but I don't know that we would have started with, like, mozzarella stick, potato skin, like, things like that. So, just curious.
Fair.
And lastly, I just want to plant this kind of thought experiment. But like,
I'm listening.
Like, what would a gay version of Fridays look like? Like, back then, but like also maybe today, like at any time. I don't know why it's so hard.
Because
to
we talk
envision.
So much about our gay Chick-fil-A franchise, you're like, what's the gay Fridays?
Oh my, that's not why. I just thought of that because, like, I was referencing, like, when I was cross-checking, like, when Stonewall was to make sure I wasn't misquoting, I was like, oh, what if there was a gay Fridays?
Well, I do feel like the amount of pins that Fridays employees used to wear back in the day does have, like, a queer energy to it.
I'm going to say it was a queer-friendly adjacent place for
workers. I just mean the amount of, like, flair on their
suspenders quite a bit.
At times.
That's true. That's true. It was loud. Flamboyant. Yeah. Actually, it had
a queer energy to it in a way that I liked.
And the soccer shirts. Yeah. Like a little fitted on the men, but also like sporty. Anyway. I think like if something like a Hamburger Mary's, which is if you're not familiar.
I'm familiar, but go on. Tell
the
listener, people in the back.
It is a bar restaurant where your servers are all in drag. And I have not been. We're planning to go very soon. But if something like that was like turned into a franchise and like pumped all around the country, like that would be Gay Fridays. And I would love it so much.
Yeah, I feel like that's right. Like Hamburger Mary's like might just be Gay Fridays.
Yeah. And then there's like frozen Hamburger Mary's food at the grocery store. I would like that.
Yeah, I'm feeling that. I feel the vibe.
And then you create a whole bunch of jobs for queer people who are in a small town, theoretically. Anyway. Before we pivot into a verbal game, after that brief snapshot, this 1 hour snapshot into history, any questions that I may or may not be able to answer? Comments? Thoughts?
I mean, what a good cue. I don't know. Did this make you like Fridays more, I guess, is a question. And it's not that you disliked Fridays before, so.
It did. It made me, like, feel better about always liking it better than the other ones. It made me feel selfishly and maybe egotistically like I could detect the authenticity. The same way that, like, I like Coke better than Pepsi. That's not true. Well, let's pretend it's true for this analogy.
You like Pepsi better than Coke?
I like the taste of Pepsi better, but I like know that Coke is cooler. And I think it's truly because I can like feel that Pepsi is like the cheater brand. And I'm just going to say that maybe as a kid, I liked Fridays better than Ruby Tuesdays and Applebee's because I knew that it was the OG. It had that thread of authenticity.
I don't think I've ever eaten at a Ruby Tuesdays, but.
Oh my God, you're missing out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The crouton. Like, I'll tell you what to get. Like, text me if you ever go there. I'll tell you what to order.
Okay, tight. Oh, man. I had a very suburbs weekend last weekend, truly. And, you know, maybe I need some of that intel later on. So you can't know. I'm open to it.
Yeah, the croutons are important.
Okay, the croutons at Ruby Tuesdays, y'all. You heard it here. Maybe not first, but you did hear it.
Definitely not first. Yeah. All right. Well, then, is it about time to wake up our musical director who's been nodding?
Oh, those mallets. I hope they're polished.
And cue it.
Cue it.
So, tonight's verbal game is a three choices with rules. So, much as Mr. Stillman had his Fridays, his initial launch, what he got cut his teeth on, but what truly ended up being his lasting legacy. And then he had his Still and Woozies or whatever the fuck the second one was called. I can't remember now.
Right. You know, listen, there's a reason people think sophomore albums are just, there's a little bit of a slump there or whatever. I don't know.
Well, he had his whole life to think of the first one, you know?
That's exactly it. His whole life up until that point.
So, much like Alan, you're going to choose one of these businesses to launch and run for about 7 years. You're going to open a few locations and then you're going to sell it, pass it off for hopefully a lot of money. And then your second business, this is kind of like your Mary choice. You're going to run that like till you retire, like that business. And then one of these businesses you don't have to fuck with at all. So that's like your kill option.
Okay.
So
one of these I'm going to run for.
You're going to run for, we'll say 7 years.
Okay.
But you won't like have any like entrepreneurial experience before that. Like by the time you do the second one, like, you've already done the first one that you've chosen.
Okay. Okay. I'm down with this. This one's my first endeavor for, okay. Mm-hmm.
And you only have to do that one for like 7 years, but then the second one you're going to do till you retire.
Wow. Okay. Damn.
So, which business do you franchise and how do you innovate it? Here we go. First choice. First choice is laundry and wings. Combo spot. All these are
like washing your clothes and eating chicken wings?
Correct.
Those are like actually two of my passions. Like, I mean, everybody, well, not everybody, but
I didn't say many these folks. I didn't say that these were not going to be fun businesses to run.
Okay, I thought I was going to be punished, but I'm like, no. I love laundry and I love chicken wings.
No, I think I wish all of these existed. So,
okay, wow, tight.
Laundry and wings is first choice. Second choice is hot tub cocktail bar. And there's a few of those that exist, but you got to be careful.
I've been at a hot tub cocktail bar.
Yeah, you know? It's pretty, yeah, I would like to go. Anyway.
It's tight.
Then your last choice is auto shop swim club.
An auto shop swim club?
Yes.
I'm not doing that. I don't care about cars.
Okay. It's the most hands-off of them, which is appealing to me, but this is about you.
Oh, sure. But I'm like, if I'm like the entrepreneur, I want some passion. I want some skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so arguably to me, it seems like the hot tub cocktail bar is a probably more lucrative business model than laundry and chicken wings. But laundry and chicken wings sounds very fun.
And like wings are like not a whole meal. So like you could always get them if you were doing laundry and like wouldn't have to be for your meal. Sorry, go on.
Well, back in the heyday, and those familiar with a specific little nook of Cincinnati, there is a laundromat that is right across from a pretty solid Mexican spot that on Wednesdays, you know, did like, or no, on Mondays did half price margaritas. And I spent much time with my like boyfriend at the time and homies at this like doing clothes, like laundry at this laundromat, and then like going across the street to like drink margaritas and like eat queso.
And you know what the double dip on that laundromat was though? It was laundry and tanning.
They had tanning inside.
I used to go there to tan. Yep.
Jamie used to go there to tan. I used to go there while other people washed their clothes, but I wanted to go across the street and eat Mexican food. So what are you going to do? Yeah, but I feel like maybe just because it feels like the correct thing, like I feel like the laundry and wings, it just for whatever reason has the energy that it would be more of a hustle for me as a young person. And I feel like I'd be like pretty hands off with just like owning this like hot tail cocktail bar or whatever.
You could call it Hot Tails. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's already been named. It was a Freudian slip and then it stuck.
So okay, you're going to be Lisa Vanderpump, basically, who is a housewife who also has the show Vanderpump Rules about her restaurants that she owns.
Tight. Isn't she the one with fucking Skinny Girl Margarita or whatever?
No. That's Bethany of New York.
Oh, yeah. That is Bethany.
You'd rather be LVP, I promise.
I mean, listen, I don't know enough about these women, but I'm here for the business. Yeah, I think I do the laundry and chicken wings first, but I'm just excited about the wings. And maybe part of that is like, I would definitely eat some wings right now as we're recording. I'd eat some wings anytime though. That's one of my other passions.
Well, that's why it's
Pablo's.
Great with laundry is because no matter what time of day you come in, you're always hungry for wings.
100%. It's kind of a brilliant business model.
And you can order just a few. Yeah.
I mean, or you could order a lot.
Or you could order a lot. Or you could incrementally order them while you're waiting and waiting and waiting for your laundry.
I'd just be switching up sauces. Nah, probably classic. I'm a classic buffalo kind of gal, but like, you know, I'd be doing rounds. And we wouldn't skimp on the celery at my location. That would be important to
us. No, absolutely not. That's what would make it, feel more legit. Not like gas station wings.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was going to say,
you know what? Here's what it would be. I would be passionate about being like the laundry and wings location, but like our wings would be so good. They would be like reviewed and like revered. And we would be like, I don't even do my laundry here, but they have some of the best wings in the city.
We're like in the LA-est.
Yeah.
Laundromat has number one wings in the city.
You know what?
That's real though. There's a sandwich here that's like the best sandwich ever. It's just like this little Italian sandwich that this old man makes at this market, like that you would never expect. Anyway,
right,
happens all the time.
I take back what I said for the hot tub and cocktail. I will start with that, and I will do the laundromat chicken wing. That's my full life. I just think I care more about those things.
It seems really
and we would
fun.
Have like good washing machines, mm-hmm. but somehow it would be like economical to do your laundry there because we would subsidize some of the laundry shit with really or just coming because we had like literally the best wings in the city. And then a bunch of people would come to us. Like they would be like, I have in unit laundry, but the chicken wings here are just incredible. And then we would be on Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives and Guy Fieri would be like, these people aren't even here for laundry. And it would be Flavor Town.
That means that we need to offer an additional service that most people don't have in their apartment. For laundry. I don't know.
What you offer them is the best chicken wing in the city. Is, I would perfect this recipe, and that's why I have to do it long term, because it's got to be like the chicken wing has got to be just like, bam.
Yeah. And I'm seeing like community events in the parking lot. I don't know. There could be really great summer nights at the laundromat.
Stop making this weird. It's just the best chicken wing, and people flock for it.
I'm just picturing all the people in line. Dancing to the music.
People are coming for my wings. Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that maybe I would actually do it the way you initially said, where I cut my teeth on the laundry and wings. Because if I'm totally honest, I think it seems like an easier business model. The hot tub introduces a lot of liability, and so does alcohol. Whereas, like,
well,
laundry machines, okay, like, those are machines. Those aren't employees. Like, you can probably keep, you know, I have a couple people working in the kitchen, a couple people out front. It's different than running a whole cocktail bar.
Here's what I do. My laundromat also would be BYO, but to BYO, you have to order wings.
There it is.
You couldn't just, like, do laundry and drink while you were doing it, because then we would have some
issues.
That's a problem. But, like,
yeah.
You could BYO if you ordered food.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's great. Yeah. Tight. And only having to manage ordering wings as far as the kitchen goes. It's great.
Ugh,
fucking love that.
God. Yeah, we'd have wings and, like, celery and, like, really fire
sauces.
Blue cheese. And, like,
that's
maybe
it.
We'd have a potato wedge.
Maybe. I don't want to fuck with the... I don't know.
Everything's going in a fryer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're right. Basket stuff will work. Anyway, so we'll continue to workshop our laundry and wing business that I'm now super excited about.
Damn. That's a really exciting business venture. I can't wait to franchise this with you.
Me too. And it really, like, hot tub cocktail bars exist, but this one, I haven't seen it.
But you know what? I can't wait for the intro on my episode of Triple D where they're like, the best wings in a laundromat. Like, you know, I mean,
they would play that guitar bed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Somebody got paid to compose that guitar riff. God bless. You guys, I'm passionate about it. Well, listen, if you've got the just like two things that you want to mash together as like the ideal business venture, I'd like to hear about it. Naturally, of course. If you've got a cameo story that rivals a sister wife that we should know about it, I'd also like to hear about it. And if you've got more hot takes on the greatest franchise foods and frozen appetizers and what we should actually be buying at Trader Joe's, as always, you can let us know on the internet via email at whyyoulikethispod@gmail.com, on Instagram at whyyoulikethispod, and on Twitter at WYLTTweets. Good night, good morning, good evening, and good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.